and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about tea time.
Yes.
It's tea time time.
It's a time for tea. And this means it's also time, at last, for us to discuss something that I have a food intolerance to.
Oh, no.
At least I think I do. I mean, I've never, officially gotten any, yes, you are intolerant to this, sort of box checked.
Sure. Well, if it just makes your guts all rumbly, usually when you go to a doctor and say, eating this makes my guts all rumbly, they'll just go, stop eating that.
And I'm like, no. And they're like, get out. If you won't take my advice. That's pretty much how a lot of my doctor's appointments go. It makes me really, itchy and nauseated, and I feel like I can't get enough water.
Oh.
And the same thing happens to me with mint. And I looked it up online, and it sounds like it, one, I'm probably brewing my tea incorrectly, or it's a certain type of tannin that's present in both of those, I think, that possibly I'm sensitive to.
Sure.
I don't know. I still drink it. And then, an hour later, I'm like, why? Because I do really like it. And I'm not the only one. After water, tea is the most consumed liquid in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. But today, we are focusing on tea time. We will come back for the whole tea episode.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's going to be a lot. I'm really excited about it. I'm excited about not doing it today.
Yes, because we're bringing in a friend of ours that some of you may have seen on a video that we did about apple pie.
Ancient apple pie. Oh, not ancient apple pie. Just really old apple pie.
Old timey pie.
Uh-huh.
And she is our good friend Julia, and she's really rad. And she is writing the book on tea time.
Yes.
So she seems like the right person to go to.
Yeah, so she joined us in the studio, and we are going to get right into it. So take it away, past Lauren and Annie. So our guest here today is Dr. Julia Skinner, who is a food historian and artist and all-around rad human person, who's also the founder and director of Root, Root being a project that explores the connections between communities and food, sort of past, present, and future, through recipes and hands-on education and discussion. She's also working on a book about afternoon tea. So, hi, Julia,
hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I've had a very broad training. So I've, my doctorate's in library science, but I do not work in a library anymore. but I did until somewhat recently, and then I left to start this food history organization that you said does a lot with community and with building that community using food. I also do a lot of research. So the afternoon tea book developed out of some research relationships I already had, and it just kind of popped up, and I was suddenly writing about afternoon tea. but I've done other projects, 17th century English food, for example. I'm right now researching Appalachian food history for an event I'm doing with the Patchworks Museum, which is here in town. So... yeah, I do other random things. I garden and I make art and I travel all over the place, and it's very, very random hodgepodge existence, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, no, all of that is incredibly exciting. Okay, you sort of said that it just sort of happened, but I don't entirely believe that you were just suddenly one day I guess this thing that I'm typing is now a whole book on afternoon tea. How did you get onto the subject of afternoon tea?
So one of my colleagues, Ken Albala, he has been a mentor and friend of mine for years, and he is editing a series on various food history topics, and he approached some folks and was like, I have all these other meals that I want to cover, and I don't have anybody to write about them. And he was like, afternoon tea, for example. And I was like, oh, I'll do that one, I guess. and so then realized I knew nothing about afternoon tea, right? And so I just was like, oh, well, I've agreed to write this book, and I've got, let's see, what was it, 2.5 years or something to figure out how to, and I was like, cool, that's plenty of time. And then, also was working full time and everything. So it's not like I could sit and just write about it, for extended periods. So we got about a year out from the deadline, and I realized I'd written like 30 pages.
Oh.
I was like, oh, God. And so the last year was a lot of very hectic writing and researching, but it got done on the deadline day.
Oh, heck, nice. Oh, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We are going to have a whole episode on the like history and science of tea itself, but in brief, what do people need to know about tea in order to start understanding afternoon tea?
I would say what I find most interesting about tea, the product, and afternoon tea, the meal, is that the meal relies on this, you know, imported product that's, you know, it's this very British thing, but the kind of the center point of it is not British at all. It didn't show up in England until the 1600s. So,
oh, wow.
So you've got that connection between an imported product and English identity. Tea itself, I ended up not learning a ton about all the different varieties and all of those things. I was surprised at the tea making process. So, you know, the leaves are fermented and you have all that stuff that happens, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
All of that I found interesting because I think I just always thought that you just like picked them off the plant and dried them and then you had tea. No.
As with many products, it's it's a surprisingly to me, to my like ignorant self, it's always a surprisingly complex process that always has to do with bacteria poop. And
yeah.
I'm like, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
It's always my favorite discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And speaking of kind of complicated, more complicated answers than you perhaps would expect. We have a tradition on this show, starting every topic with the basic question that bears a very complicated answer, which we spend the rest of the episode unpacking, and that is, what is it? So, afternoon tea.
What is it?
So, afternoon tea is a meal that, you know, we all, when we think of afternoon tea, we think of all the little tea trays and all the little, you know, fancy pedophores and all that kind of stuff.
And dainty little cups.
Dainty little cups.
Finger
having
sandwiches.
Having your fingers out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Except for you don't actually want to do that.
Oh.
Apparently.
Oh, okay. Pinkies back in.
Yes. Bring
pinkies
your pinkies
retracted.
Back in. Yes. But it's got this incredibly complex history and, you know, where how we refer to it depends, you know, where we are geographically, what Americans think it is versus what it tends to mean for a British person having a daily snack meal is pretty different. There's a lot going on there. The American version is more based on the original kind of version, the fancy, you know, version that the nobility had, as opposed to just kind of everyday people food.
And the fancy version isn't actually called, okay, so there's different types of tea time. There's mm-hmm. afternoon tea, there's high tea, there's low tea. I think tea time is another term that's actually used mm-hmm. for kind of a different thing. And yeah. You'd think that from the term high tea, that would mean the fancy one.
Nope.
But that's not what it means.
Low tea is the fancy one. Initially, low tea was named that, from what I've researched it, because people sat in like low chairs and did, you know, sat at their low table in their fancy dresses, which for some reason that was a thing.
sure, as you do.
Why not? Uh-huh. And so that was, you know, low tea referred to kind of the table setting, and that was where you got that. And high tea was had at a you know, a dinner table, so higher up, you know, kind of what we would think of as a normal sitting space. And referred to dinner by the working class once we got a little later in the century. So, you know, closer to the 1900s. An afternoon tea just kind of refers to all of the afternoon snack meal, both the low tea version and just kind of like, here's a more casual snack meal. And tea time refers to dinner when you're up in the northern counties.
Oh,
wow,
perfect.
It all makes sense.
Yeah. Yep.
Clear as day.
And there's probably like all these other variations on all of that too that just, you know, my research didn't even uncover all the nuance of, because I've, you know, looked at it for several years, but I feel like I only scratched the surface. Like writing a 250-page book turns out was not even enough.
Oh. So.
We can relate to that.
Yeah.
Mm.
We have more to say about tea time, but first we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And let's get right back to our discussion on tea time.
How did this whole tradition begin?
So there's some debate about it. The standard tends to be that the Duchess of Bedford in the 1840s, you know, got hungry and had a snack brought up to her room, and then all of, you know, started bringing all of her friends. And because she was very popular in the English court, then she became, she was an influencer of whatever ilk. And so she then influenced everybody else to want to do this. And then, you know, it kind of spread through English society from there. And that's mostly true. There's some folks that have argued that that's overly simplistic, which, I mean, it kind of is. But but it actually is pretty close to the truth from what I've found. So there was one food blogger whose name I can't remember. I would have to look it up. But they referred to that as the Bedford Orthodoxy, that you... like, if you somehow went against this perception of how afternoon tea happened and, you know, started and all of that, that you were, you know, blaspheming the history of this meal.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's intense. People get really intense about this stuff. It's a lot. but this particular blogger, you know, referred to it as that, and then somebody else came back, and they're like, okay, you're right. Like, we all do tend to focus on this one thing. But it is actually pretty close to true, and you know, all the other things you're bringing in as data points are not, you know, don't negate this person's influence. So basically, the kind of the full picture of what I've seen is, like, of course, this isn't the first person who's ever had
a snack.
Yeah, had a snack in the afternoon.
Sure, like
that happened before 1840. It turns out. Yeah, it was like, okay, she's not the person that started that as a, you know, as a thing, but she is the person that popularized it as an actual meal with its own codified traditions and everything. So, yeah, so she was basically the person that did that.
What are some of those codified like etiquette related things? Do you have any favorite weird ones? Can you explain the whole process? Or, I mean, I that might be too big of a question.
And it depends. Like, when you're just like having afternoon tea with your family or friends in your home, it's much more relaxed and whatever. If you're out for fancy tea, it's a little more more structured. So, for example, if you stir your tea, you want to be sure to stir it circularly and not like back and forth, so you don't hit the sides of the cup with your spoon, because that makes noise and that's apparently bad.
Sure.
I'm not fancy enough to do actual tea. Like, I've tried it a couple times and I'm just like, I'm failing. I'm sorry, guys. Like, I'm too much of a trash person for this. So, yeah, and like the pinkies out thing, you're not supposed to do. That apparently is considered tacky and something that, like, yeah, that I think we, for some reason, culturally assume looks fancy. And I'm not sure why, but it tends to be associated with people who have not actually ever done tea time me kind of things.
Oh,
before,
okay. So, oh, look at that plebe trying to pretend that they're good like we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I have no idea.
I find it useful. I feel like it helps you balance.
Yeah.
I do it like with Coke.
Oh, yeah.
I don't drink Coke. What am I talking about? With canned drinks. My pinky just naturally comes out.
Yeah. I always, when I was a kid, I did that. Like, my dad called me Pris when I was a kid, because my pinkies would stick out when I would, you know, drink, like, out of a bottle or a sippy cup or anything.
that's adorable.
As an adult, so now I'm, like, hyper aware of it. I'm like, no.
Must keep fingers clenched at all times.
Yes, yes.
Were there any other little bits and bobs of etiquette that you wanted to talk about?
That's the one that most comes to mind. There's all sorts of other kind of little things. But for some reason, the teacup, like stirring the teacup properly, really stuck with me, because it's something I just have never thought of. And then when I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, you have to think about really literally every movement if you want to do this, you know, properly, like if I'm having, you know, tea with the queen, which is never going to happen, but if it did, I would have to think about how I'm stirring my tea.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound like a relaxing time at all.
No, I wouldn't think so.
How did this very English, very upper class concept spread throughout the world?
Well, so 1840s was when this started becoming popular. And so that's, if you look at broader English history, that's when, so English had been a colonial power for some time, but colonialism was really getting much more extra. There was a lot more of it happening.
Yes. It was gearing up.
It was gearing up. There we go. Hence, that makes more sense.
No, I think that much more extra is also an appropriate descriptor. They were pretty heckin' extra.
They were. They really were. Yeah, and so as this became popular, there was it started out as an upper class tradition, kind of moving through the upper class, and then, you know, as you see with some other food traditions, people who were middle class or upper middle class who were trying to emulate people that were wealthier would start to do the, you know, pick up various cultural traditions that they felt would go with, went with that that status, and then it just kind of moved through English society from there and became pretty entrenched pretty quickly. I mean, by the time we're at 1900, it's a pretty established thing. And mm-hmm. so the English colonial power is still growing at this time. And so more and more English people are going around the world colonizing things and or settling in colonies, bringing with them these traditions. And so that's how it spread.
And how has all of that changed from the 18 and 1900s to today? Is there anything shockingly new in the afternoon tea scene?
There's a lot more variety in afternoon teas. So there's a lot of fusion afternoon teas in England now. So there's ones that either bring components from different cultures, which I find fascinating because they're ones that have components from all of these different cultures that have been colonized by England. And then their foods are being brought to a fancy $30 or $40 a person meal in England. It's this weird interplay that makes me feel a lot of feelings. Yeah, there's a lot more variety in England, but there's still, you know, the very staunch traditional kind of tea as well. And then there's around the world, I was amazed by the consistency of afternoon tea in different colonies. So even in India, where you see local, you know, fried snacks and things as an accompaniment, you also still see finger sandwiches and stuff that are decidedly not Indian foods.
Right.
That are still holdovers just because they're so closely associated with that meal.
Huh. Have you had the opportunity to experience any of these modern tea times?
So I was in England in high school for a couple weeks and I had, tried it a couple times then. I've tried a handful of them here in the States, including at Dr. Bombay's, which is very nice. And, you know, much more in line with my, I want a relaxed experience of a pot of tea and then just, give me a lot of small food, please.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very chill there.
Yeah. I've had, as an adult, the fancy tea a couple times, gone in and, gone to, it's usually the hotel restaurants that seem to do that the most.
Sure, yeah.
And so I've tried that a couple times. I don't really like it as much as a smaller cafe, but yeah. I know a lot of people do because every fancy hotel has that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always wonder how many people really show up for those things and whether they're, again, yeah, kind of these this middle class people kind of presuming to this upper class level.
Yeah.
And or whether if people from Europe come over here, they just expect it at fancy places. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and I think, when Americans go over to England too, I think we expect that's kind of what fancy in England is denoted as in
right.
our minds.
And, right.
Yeah. So they're, you don't see here how we have hotel high tea. You don't see it called high tea over there because, again, the many many strong opinions about naming and regional variations and everything. And so, Yeah, and here we just kind of call it whatever, and people are like, oh, it's fancy.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of our tipping episode where the U.S. didn't tip until rich people went over to Europe, and they kind of tipped, and then they were like, oh, let's show how rich
fancy.
We are,
yes.
And start tipping, and then Europe got rid of it, and we went completely in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's a thing of people visiting Europe and wanting to come back and re-experience what they think is quite fancy.
Well, and it's interesting here because in the U.S., so we were no longer a colony by the time that afternoon tea developed as a meal. I mean, we hadn't been for, you know, over 100 years or 100 years or whatever by the time it really got popular. So it wasn't until the 20th century, like the 1920s, that people were like, ooh, afternoon tea, that's fancy. And then it kind of, here and in England, almost faded out completely in the 90s, like 80s and 90s. There was this... Huh. This whole thing where afternoon tea almost disappeared, but then it didn't. And now it's back with greater popularity, both and in England.
Really?
Yeah.
Is there a historical source for, I mean, is there like a theory of why that happened?
I think it was just that people, so afternoon tea developed because we had such a long break between lunch and dinner, right? And so I think it developed because people were kind of having more grab-and-go foods and would, you know, go to a coffee house and whatever, and afternoon tea where you'd get, like, you know, a crappy, like, tea bag and whatever. Like, they kind of stopped putting a lot of work into it. And so then afternoon tea just became, like, here's, like, some tea and, like, a scone. And so, like, nobody really wanted that anymore. And then it kind of got more popular. People started, you know, being like, oh, we can bring in these other teas, herbal teas, for example, in addition to just regular black tea.
Yeah.
More variety of stuff to go with it. Yeah. And then it started picking back up.
So. Yeah. I guess probably also, in conjunction with the spread of those like premium tea stores in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love how the 80s was just the death of a lot of amazing culture. That's... we talk more or less continually about... every time we talk about a alcoholic beverage, it went through a dark time in the 80s when it just didn't happen and it almost died out.
Well, yeah. What was it about, like, beverages in the 80s? Like, why? Just all of them.
It was, like, kind of cheap and flashy to, like, not use the natural ingredients anymore. You would use, like, pre-packaged sugary stuff and just... show off, like, hey.
Hey, look how modern I am.
Look how modern. Look how bright this drink is.
Yeah, sort of like the mid-century thing where all of a sudden it was just like, why use real food when you can use Jell-O?
Yeah.
Sorry,
for everything.
Jell-O. Yeah.
For everything. It is like that because aspics were a way to be, like, both cheap and to show off.
Yeah. Fancy Jell-O.
Yeah. We've really hit something on the head here.
Yep. Not sure what.
not sure.
We've really hit the Jell-O on the head.
Yes.
What would if you could have your own ultimate afternoon tea, what would it be? What would it consist of?
I think for me, more than the stuff on the table, what I love about afternoon tea is that it was developed. You know, it started as, like, this person having a snack, but then it quickly developed that she was bringing her friends with her. And so it pretty much from the get-go was a very community-oriented gathering. So it was very casual, hang out, chat. So for me, it would be more about having people around me that I wanted to, you know, be comfortable with and be around. You know, and probably somebody who knows more about actual varieties of tea selecting the tea for me. I don't know a ton about that. So, yeah. And, I mean, I'll be honest. I know that they're, you know, kind of cheesy, but I do like tiny finger sandwiches. And I will eat a lot of them in one sitting. I've surprised myself when I was writing this book how many I could eat. I think it was at, like, 20 or 25.
Heck yeah. They're very small.
They are. Yeah.
They go away in, like, one bite.
They do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've always found it interesting, and I kind of touched on this, I can't remember what episode it was forever ago, but that tea time was a pretty much female thing, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a male-sanctioned, go hang out and gossip, ladies, sort of time, and tea was feminized for a while as, like, this is a drink for ladies, and mm-hmm. women weren't even allowed in, like, a lot of coffee shops. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was?
I mean, I think just, you know, because it was a gathering of women, I think it was like, oh, we don't have to take that seriously because it's just, you know, women having their little chats. And so, you know, whatever stuff is associated with that then, like you said, is less, becomes less important by association. Even though, you know, afternoon tea gatherings and things are just general tea gatherings, even if they weren't, you know, specifically the meal, were still a space where a lot of, like, women's suffrage conversations were happening and all this stuff. So it wasn't like people were just getting together and being like, oh, hey, nice shoes for an hour.
Right.
it turns out we sometimes actually have other meaningful conversations in each other's presence.
Weird.
Yeah, I know. Crazy.
Shocking. Yeah.
Perhaps that's the surprise of the episode.
Yeah. So many surprises. Yeah, but it's interesting because then later on, afternoon tea, as men started working more in offices and things, so with the Industrial Revolution and all of that, and where people started doing more work away from home and going home during the day to, say, eat lunch or something, mm-hmm. wasn't as likely to happen. People at least that were, you know, say middle management or something, like, you know, that had some access to resources would often have afternoon tea. And so it became also a male space eventually in addition to a female one. But the male space was more like it's a men's break from work where, you know, and it was reframed as like a break from your long work day as opposed to a, you know, just a cute little gathering with your girlfriends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like a social and hunger issue. Mm-hmm. Like yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Again, take it more seriously, seen more mm-hmm. importantly than like the silly thing that the ladies are doing.
Yeah. Even though it was almost exactly the same thing. It was like,
right.
You know, these clubs that men would go to that would have small foods and tea, and they would sit there together, you know, in, you know, mm-hmm. whatever room, the parlor or salon or whatever the hell you call it, and sit there and, you know, chat. And so literally the same thing.
Yeah.
But guys. Mm-hmm.
But dudes, though.
Yeah.
But dudes, though.
But dudes, though. Yeah.
Right.
Do you know why women were excluded from coffee drinking at the time? Oh, no. Annie
does.
Because the men, they'd be talking about them ladies using profanities and smoking. They didn't want no ladies up in there. It was seen as very risque. It was a certain type of woman that you did not want to be would go into those coffee houses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's also where they did a lot of talking about politics and stuff, which, you know, I guess we also weren't supposed to be participating in.
Sure.
Sure.
Clearly not.
Too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for a while, wasn't it the case that women couldn't even, like, go in and buy tea in a shop? Like, they had to send somebody in mm-hmm. and then just, like, stand outside?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Several coffee houses, I know, like, I'm pretty sure Twining started out as a coffee house, mm-hmm. and women weren't allowed in, but then they kind of made a pretty calculated switch mm-hmm. as like men were coming into the tea game to switch mm-hmm. over to tea. Yeah, but coffee houses were seen as the men's only. And that's, I always kind of thought maybe that was another reason that tea was such a big thing for women. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
How it got so kind of gendered. But I suppose we do that with most things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's accurate.
Did you read any about Argentine, like, tango tea times?
Argentine tango tea time.
Yes.
I don't think so. What is it? That doesn't sound familiar, but it sounds fascinating.
So I read in the 1900s, these tea dances became a thing called tango teas. And they were inspired by Argentine tango. And it's sort of, again, one of those interesting things of colonization and mm-hmm. kind of this mishmash of cultures. And people would like dance a tango and
have some tea.
And have some tea.
It sounds messy.
It does, right? Maybe that's where the pinkies.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Pinkies can help you out. I don't know. I don't know if anything can help you out in that situation.
No. Sippy cup, maybe.
Sippy cup tea time.
That's what we need.
That's the future right mm-hmm, there.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other around the world kind of traditions that you know of off the top of your head that you find super interesting?
I mean, most of them, that one makes me think of another thing that was that happened, I think it was like 20s or 30s maybe, where people would have, it wasn't called a tango tea time, but it was called just like a tea dance or something like that. And it was basically a money and labor saving effort to still have large gatherings. So you would basically set up a sideboard with a bunch of tea and a bunch of snacks. So it would be like afternoon tea, but it was also like hundreds of people hanging out in your giant house and just going and helping themselves to the things. And so it was much lower impact than like having a banquet or whatever.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Like a cocktail hour almost, but with tea instead
with
of
tea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was, you know, and they would have it around the same time as the meal and whatever. But it seems like it only lasted for, I don't know, maybe a couple decades, and then people kind of were over it. But otherwise, really the structure of the meal is being, you know, a little snacky thing and a, you know, a beverage. And the big critical thing about it with all of the people that I talked to from around the world when I was doing this book is that it's a space where you have to, like, pause and take a break. Like, it's not like a meal that you can have that you're, like, you know, also checking your email and, like, eating your scone. Like, no, you're there with that food and that drink. Like, you have to show up and just be there with it for a minute and with whatever people you're with. So, and that seems pretty pretty consistent everywhere.
Huh.
Yeah.
I think the first time I did a tea time in England.
Yeah.
I was young and I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know what was happening. And it was so, I could tell it was so important. And people were taking, like, they just had such specific things they were doing. So I went up and I had my cup of tea and I was looking at everybody and I, like, poured some milk in. And some people were like, nodding. I'm making faces no one can see. Some people were totally on board and some people were giving me very judgy faces. And then I was like, okay. And I put lemon in there and some people were like, like actual sounds. And I'm just like, oh, what's happening? I'm doing everything wrong. I put like a little bit of everything in the teacup. And then it was not the best tea at all because clearly you shouldn't.
No.
Probably shouldn't put everything in there. But I sipped it slowly and I was trying to act like it was good. Like that was what I wanted.
Right.
And I knew it, but I'm sure they were all horrified.
Yeah. They were on to you.
I'm pretty sure they were very on to me. I was not fooling anybody. But it was nice. I liked that. I liked the sort of sitting around and talking to people and having mm-hmm. that moment.
Yeah.
Slowly sipping the tea.
Yeah.
It's nice. And I'm wondering now, especially given the time period when this kind of came about, if it was related to the like temperance and prohibition type movements that were happening around the world at the time. Like get rid of that alcohol, drink this tea. Yeah.
The meal kind of came about a little bit before that, but I think, you know, tea drinking, like you said, definitely increased during temperance because everybody was wanting an alternative to alcohol. The meal doesn't seem like it, from what I researched, and so I'd be interested if you guys found something in addition to this, but it seems like the meal itself was already pretty popularized by that point. So the meal didn't get really more popular, but other gatherings around tea. So like instead of having an afternoon tea, having like some other social hour or, you know, more tea in the home or whatever, that became more popular then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I haven't found a ton about the relationship between the two.
I haven't seen anything about it, but it just, like, something in my brain went, like, ping.
Wait a minute.
It really did change a lot. Prohibition really really changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
Now you can get cocktails with tea in them.
What a world.
What a world we live in. Cocktail that, tea hour.
Does that count as tea time?
It does.
It doesn't mean much.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Anything that we should have asked you? Any fun, weird facts?
Fun, weird facts. I mean, there's so many, but of course, because there are so many, they're all just like flying around in my brain, and I'm like, there's so much. I feel like we've covered kind of a lot of the big stuff about it. You know, I just find it such a fascinating meal. Like, I was expecting to write this book and have it be pretty much like, here's a lot of stuff about etiquette and all of this stuff. I ended up barely talking about etiquette because tea is a part of English identity and, also is a part of English colonialism, just caught my interest so much that that's most of what I ended up writing about.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Probably more interesting than etiquette.
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, yeah. Colonialism, and there's certainly a lot to unpack there.
Yes, there definitely. Is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not even get close to doing it in the book. I mean, I did some, but not as much as I thought I would have. There was a lot there.
Did the English tradition of tea time ever make it back over to the specific places where they were importing their tea from in the first place?
Not really. Like, in the 20th century, there are some, Chinese hotels and things that'll have it. But most of the tea that was coming to England at this time was Chinese. And, since China wasn't really, there were little chunks kind of on the edge that were part of the colonies. But China itself, was its own thing. So not really until recently.
And they already had their own tea time type traditions.
Yeah, they've got all their own stuff going on that I don't even know hardly anything about, but I know exists.
Yeah. Also a thing that I'd love to go sit awkwardly at.
Yes.
And do
yes.
the wrong things.
Yes.
There's some in Japan that last like 3 to 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. To get to whet your interest for our like tea episode, the fact that Britain was so obsessed with tea in part led to the Opium Wars with China, mm-hmm. and is what made them go, one, invent clipper ships, and two, go start planting tea in India, mm-hmm. so that they wouldn't have to depend on China
anymore.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and once they did that, there's also just stuff about labor practices in India that, go on with that. Obviously not, great, happy things about labor practices there. But, very poor wages and things like that. But, yeah, it's an afternoon tea is still in India. Never in China, but definitely in India.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the clipper ships. They did clipper ship races for a long time. It was crazy.
They were like time. Who could get back with the most tea the fastest?
Oh, what? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man. Did you win a prize?
I think you just were, like, famous or
bragging
something.
Right.
Like big ups.
Rights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fair enough. That sounds terrifying, so.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess people watched it with a lot of interest, which I would, too, if we still had clipper ship races.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was funny when I first ran across that term. I'd heard it before, but I wasn't entirely sure what it is. Mm-hmm. And I kind of dismissed it. And then it kept coming up, so it must have been a really big deal. And then yeah. I started looking into it. I'm very glad I did, because it was fascinating and kind of silly.
Yeah.
That's a lot of history for you, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much for being here, Julia. This has been great.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. If people want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
You can follow my business on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at Root Kitchens, R-O-O-T Kitchens. My website is root-kitchens.com. The Root Kitchens was taken, so there's a hyphen.
Oh.
And then my email is julia@root-kitchens.com. So
awesome.
All of these ways.
Yay.
Yay.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We still have a little bit more for you listeners, but first, one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, and thank you to Julia for joining us. And this brings us to
listener mail.
Pinky's out for that one.
Pinky's out.
Mm-hmm.
Makes for great audio.
It does. It does. Sam wrote, so just listen to the cotton candy episode. I hate it just as much as you do, believe me. But whenever I see this thing in stores, it just gives me shivers because it is oddly weird but oddly satisfying seeing this as a Canadian, though, because it also touches on another episode. And yes, you guessed it. Maple syrup flavored cotton candy.
Huh.
I have tried it in the past, and it's not the greatest thing I've ever consumed in my daily life. Those reviews, they're my favorite types of reviews. I love, like, low-key, like...
Like, it was sort of meh.
Yeah, it was sort of meh. I remember Maurice Sendak wrote a review of Stephen Colbert's children's book, and it was, I didn't hate it. I love that.
Oh, Maurice. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Pedro wrote in on Facebook, I was just listening to your podcast on basil, and since I'm from Portugal, I felt I had to write in. It's true that there is an ancient tradition of offering basil in a clay vase to your loved one. The matter, however, is a bit more complicated. You only do it in June, especially on the day of the patron saint of the city where you live, or around that time. The most popular patron saints are St. Anthony in Lisbon and St. John the Baptist in Oporto. How about an episode on port wine, by the way? Also, the kind of basil that one offers is not the same one used in the kitchen, Ockhamum basilicum, but a different variety, Ockhamum minimum, with much smaller leaves, but just as fragrant. We call it Manjerico. Further tradition demands that you should have a paper carnation in the vase and four verses dedicated to your loved one. You should also never smell the basil directly with your nose, but rather use your hand to do it. And he included a photo of a stand where just a whole bunch of these little pots, little earthenware pots of basil were being sold. With these bright and colorful paper carnations stuck into each pot, little verses of poetry. Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
It was lovely. And thank you so much, Pedro, for writing in.
Yeah, it's been great hearing. I love it when we can get like a real confirmation.
Yeah.
Not from the internet or book world, but from people that are actually existing, sending us stories and pictures.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So please keep those coming. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at foodstuffhsw, also on Instagram at foodstuff. We hope so much to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Dylan Fagan. He does great work.
He does.
Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.